Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 934. The Making of Donald Trump, subtitled Top Banana Republic, Part 3. This is being recorded on November 23rd of the year 2016. This is Thanksgiving Eve, and there are many people around the world who can feel very thankful indeed for the ascent of Donald Trump. First and foremost, the underground Reich, and in this country, it's quote alt-right, unquote, street-level foot soldiers. Leave it to America, by the way, to come up with a politically correct term for fascism, in this case, alt-right. Certainly, the Trump family, including Donald's children, have much to be thankful for. They are going to be able to continue working in the Trump business empire, whose workings we will be talking about more in this program in a little bit. Many people around the world will have much to be thankful for in connection with Trump's elevation. The Koch brothers, powerful corporations, the economic elites in this country that are associated with them, their political foot soldiers at the operational level, all have much to be thankful for. Many other people, including, I suspect, many in the audience, well, in the parlance of our time, not so much. One of the things that prompted me to do what I'm doing in this series, and I'm going to interrupt this, I think, next week, briefly at least, to update people on what's going on with the Truppenkampfverband. There is a lot going on in the world, and I'm going to be getting to that as well as what is going on in this country. But the ascent of Trump is very significant. It is, as I have said, and as I will further develop next week, the transformation of the underground Reich from an underground institution, albeit one heavily embedded in our corporate structure, our financial structure, our national security, intelligence, and military structures, as well as those of other countries. It had not been transformed into a mass popular movement with a visible and dominant street presence. That has now happened. There are many who bear partial responsibility for that ascent. And, well, I talk about them sometimes, and we'll enumerate some more of that next week. I would note that, in passing, that the so-called progressive sector, as always, note the use of the term so-called, has seen a glimmer of hope in Donald Trump's meeting with a Hawaiian congresswoman named Tulsi T-U-L-S-I Gabbard, G-A-B-B-A-R-D. She was, I believe, vice chairman of the Democratic National Committee, resigned so she could support Bernie Sanders, and then was being bruited about and in some write-in ballots. She was the vice presidential candidate for Bernie Sanders. She, like myself, is opposed to wars of foreign intervention and regime change. She has been hailed as sort of the Hawaiian Madonna de Lourdes. And this, again, has been seen as a sign of hope from the progressive sector. Well, Bernie Sanders' high-profile supporter and potential vice presidential candidate. Turns out not only to be a Hindu American, which is fine, and the first Hindu elected to Congress, which is fine, but she also turns out to be an ardent supporter of Narendra Modi, and in fact helped to arrange the particulars for Narendra Modi's U.S. visit. Narendra Modi and his BJP party are political fronts for and cat's paws for the RSS. That is a Hindu nationalist slash fascist organization, which arose at the same time as and was modeled on the Nazi Party, Mussolini's black shirts, and some of their cadre patterned on the SS, the Nazi SS. It was a member of the RSS who murdered Mahatma Gandhi, who favored reconciliation and coexistence between Hindus and Indian Muslims. The RSS, as is the case with fascist parties, demonizes Muslims, who for the RSS are the demonic, evil, quote, other, unquote, against whom everyone should rally. For the Muslim fascists of the Muslim Brotherhood, in Europe and North America, it is the infidels, i.e. Jews and Christians, and no doubt in the Indian subcontinent, places like Pakistan and India proper, the malevolent other is the Hindus. And again, St. Gabbard is an ardent supporter of Narendra Modi, whose ascent was financed in part by Pierre Omidyar and eBay. He also, Omidyar, that is, helped to finance the Maidan coup that saw the OUNB heirs come to power in Ukraine. And, of course, it is Omidyar and his First Look Media that were the receptors for some of the documents that were purloined by Eddie Snowden. And it is also at The Intercept that Glenn Greenwald is holding forth. Greenwald, a Nazi fellow traveler, and like Eddie Snowden, like Julian Assange, like Pierre Omidyar and so many others, is the opposite of what he is represented as being. Stephen K. Bannon of Breitbart News, the quote alt-right unquote campaign manager for Donald Trump and now a top advisor in the White House to Donald Trump, was very much enthused about Tulsi Gabbard. He also is a big fan of Narendra Modi, as well as Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party. So the dance continues. More about that next week. There was, as I read in the first of these programs, that is to say, for the record, 932, The Making of Donald Trump, Top Banana Republic, Part 1, there was a poll taken by ABC News shortly before the election that showed by something like a 43 to 36% margin, prospective voters viewed Donald Trump as more trustworthy than Hillary Clinton, something that in and of itself bears mute and yet eloquent testimony to just how far this country has fallen. That Donald Trump could be seen as more honest than Hillary Clinton is quite remarkable, a tribute to our media, a tribute to the fence post political awareness of the average American, who at this point, frankly, couldn't tell a dirt road from a chicken with lips. And it is an indictment of our media in particular. I thought by way of providing listeners with something of a chevron by which they can measure the descent of America and really the Caligulization of America, as our new Caligula assumes the position of leadership, or at least nominally, continues to administer his business affairs through his children in defiance of all precedent, and has, of course, refused to release his income tax returns. And I have been reading into the record, and will continue to read into the record in most of its content, a very, very good book named called The Making of Donald Trump by David K. Johnston, K is C-A-Y, published in hardcover by Melville House and copyright 2016. We're going to resume with our readings of that in just a minute. And I will have, by the way, a copy of the article about Americans finding Donald Trump more honest than Hillary Clinton in the written description, for the record, 934. However, I'm going to begin, as I have the other shows, like I say, ended 933 with this, by reading a poem that really encapsulates my feelings about what is going on, and a poem in which I take a measure of solace. Perhaps you can as well. The poem is called Be Angry at the Sun by Robinson Jeffers. The public men publish falsehoods is nothing new. That America must accept, like the historical republics, corruption and empire has been known for years. Be angry at the sun for setting, if these things anger you. Watch the wheel slope and turn. They are all bound on the wheel, these people, those warriors, this republic, Europe, Asia. Observe them gesticulating. Observe them going down. The gang serves lies. The passionate man plays his part. The cold passion for truth hunts in no pack. You are not capitalists, you know, to lampoon these crude sketches of Caesar. You are far from Dante's feet, but even farther from his dirty political hatreds. Let boys want pleasure, and men struggle for power, and women perhaps for fame, and the servile to serve a leader, and the dupes to be duped. Yours is not theirs. That again, Be Angry at the Sun by Robinson Jeffers. We're going to jump in roughly where we left off in, for the record, 933. I'm going to overlap this reading with our last, and we were talking about some of the very shady dealings of Donald Trump, including his remarkable relationship with a convicted major drug trafficker, a guy named Joey Weichselbaum, W-E-I-C-H-S-E-L-B-A-U-M, who, along with his brother, was involved with all sorts of shady and criminal activity. And the relationship of the Trump casino business to the Weichselbaum brothers, both in terms of helicopters and limousines, and the Weichselbaums were involved with both, is something that we covered in our last program.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We're going to jump in, and when Weichselbaum was in court and being brought to heel, at least to a certain extent, for his operations, some very unusual things happened. Now, bear in mind, Donald Trump, or his successor, if, as I suspect, he eventually will be eased out of office. He makes a very good front man, but he doesn't know much of anything about anything. He is an extremely ignorant man when it comes to policy. But then again, look at Ronald Reagan. I mean, he couldn't. I remember during the 1980 campaign, he was asked what he thought about solar energy. And he said, quote, "Well, I've been standing in the sun all day and my feet are still cold." What a brilliant individual. But that is how it goes. Weichselbaum had some very unusual kid glove treatment for in his legal case. And one of the interesting things concerns the behavior of Judge Marianne Trump, Barry Donald Trump's older sister. I mention this because Donald Trump, or his successor, is going to be appointing much of the Supreme Court, as well as many appellate court judges, and this is going to, between the Supremes and the other federal judgeships, it is going to dominate American jurisprudence and law and civil society for decades, and that bodes very poorly indeed. Turning to David K. Johnston's The Making of Donald Trump, about Joey Weichselbaum and the unusual handling of his case. When Weichselbaum made a deal with prosecutors to plead guilty to one of the 18 counts in the Cincinnati, Ohio case, something very suspicious happened. His case was transferred out of Ohio for the guilty plea and the sentencing. Logically, the case might have gone to South Florida, where Weichselbaum's Bradford Motors was located, or to New York, where Weichselbaum lived. Indeed, that is exactly what Weichselbaum's Ohio lawyer Arnold Morelli, M-O-R-E-L-L-I, sought in a January 30th, 1986 motion requesting his case be transferred to either Manhattan or Miami for, quote, "the convenience of human beings such as the defendant and witnesses," unquote. Instead, the Weichselbaum case was moved to New Jersey. There, it was assigned to Judge Marianne Trump Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, Donald Trump's older sister. Judge Barry recused herself 3 weeks later as judicial ethics required, but the mere act of removing herself from the case came with a powerful message. A sitting federal judge, as well as her husband, lawyer John Barry, and family, repeatedly flew in helicopters connected to a major drug trafficker. Any new judge assigned to the case, including the district's presiding judge, was on notice that this case had the potential to embarrass the bench. When Judge Harold A. Ackerman, A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N, replaced Trump's sister, Trump wrote him a letter seeking leniency for Weichselbaum on the drug trafficking charge. Trump characterized the defendant as, quote, "a credit to the community," unquote, and described Weichselbaum as, quote, "conscientious, forthright, and diligent," unquote, in his dealings with the Trump Plaza and Trump's Castle casinos. When asked about the letter under oath in a private 1990 meeting with New Jersey Division of Gaming Enforcement lawyers, Trump testified that he could not recall whether, quote, "he had written any letters of reference to the federal judge who sentenced Weichselbaum," unquote. Subsequently, the division obtained such a letter, and Trump acknowledged that it bore his signature. 2 years later, the DGE had to explain itself publicly after journalist Wayne Barrett's unauthorized 1992 biography of Trump revealed that letter. The DGE, citing my reporting on the issue, published a report on 14 issues raised by Barrett. Its report said nothing about what would prompt Trump to write such a letter, whether he actually believed what he wrote, and what his purpose was in writing it. The DGE lawyers merely recorded Trump's denial, then later his admission that he had in fact signed the letter. That was typical of the DGE lawyers, who declined again and again to ask probing questions that might raise deeper issues about Trump's fitness to hold a license. Likewise, the DGE's response to Barrett's book did not request an explanation of the unusual terms under which Trump rented an apartment he personally owned to the Weitzelbaum brothers. As with other matters, like the accusations made by high roller Bob Labutti, L-I-B-U-T-T-I, the DGE took Trump at his word and avoided asking questions that might require more investigation. Judge Ackerman gave Weitzelbaum a sentence that stood in stark contrast to the sentences levied on the others named in the Cincinnati indictment. The small fish got sentences of up to 20 years. Weitzelbaum, the ringleader, got 3. He served only 18 months of those 3 years. When he was up for early release, Weitzelbaum told his parole officer that he already had work lined up. He was Donald Trump's new helicopter consultant. He also said he would be moving into Trump Tower. While he was behind bars, Weitzelbaum's girlfriend bought 2 adjoining 39th-story Trump Tower apartments numbered 49A and 49B because Trump skipped 10th-floor numbers to inflate the apparent height of his signature building erected a few years earlier. The price was $2.4 million. Trump confirmed to the DGE that he believed Weitzelbaum moved into Trump Tower and lived with a girlfriend after he was released from prison, but said he had no contact with him except for seeing him in the building. Weitzelbaum also told his probation officer that he had known about Marla Maples, Trump's mistress, long before that relationship became public knowledge. He said he tried to talk Trump into ending the affair. He said Trump asked him to let Marla stay at the Trump Plaza high-rise apartment the Weitzelbaum brothers rented from him, just a few blocks from Trump Tower. The DGE dismissed this, saying simply that it was, quote, not in possession of any credible information which would suggest that DJT asked Weitzelbaum to permit his friend Marla Maples to reside in the Weitzelbaum condominium. DJT has emphatically denied this allegation. Unquote. The report offered no indication that the DGE had interviewed Weitzelbaum, his brother, Marla Maples, the probation officer, or anyone else who might have contradicted Trump's denial. Again, not asking questions was key to how the DGE protected its own reputation while simultaneously protecting casino owners from themselves. As a casino owner, Trump could have lost his license for associating with Weitzelbaum, but the DGE never asked whether he had any financial entanglement, obviously undisclosed, with Weitzelbaum or anyone connected to him, including whether he had staked any of the drug deals based on its publicly released reports. Without the DGE putting into the public record the very obvious questions, together with the answers about what motivated Trump to make such risky moves, including denying the letter he wrote seeking soft treatment for Weitzelbaum, we can only speculate about what may have influenced Trump's conduct regarding the major drug trafficker. Trump called my home in the spring of 2016 when I was working on a long piece for Politico magazine about his ties to various criminals. After a few questions about what I was up to, Trump asked what I wanted to know, even though he already had my 21 questions in writing. I asked what motivated him to write the letter for Weitzelbaum. Trump said he, quote, hardly knew, unquote, the man and didn't remember anything about him. When I reminded Trump, and he said on national television just a few months earlier that he has, quote, the world's greatest memory, unquote, Trump just said that, quote, that was long ago, unquote. As Trump often does in calls to journalists, he told me he liked some of my work and that I had been fair at times. Then, without a pause, he added that if he didn't like what I was about to publish, he would sue me. That last comment surprised me a bit. Trump knows that I am not intimidatable. I reminded him that he is a public figure. Under the law, that means a libel suit would require him to show that I wrote something with reckless disregard for the truth, something no one has ever accused me of in nearly 50 years of investigative reporting. Quote, I know I'm a public figure, but I'll sue you anyway, he said before ringing off. Weichselbaum was not the last unsavory character Trump got close to. More recently, Trump chose to work with a convicted art thief who goes by the name of Joey No Socks, unquote, as well as with the son of a Russian mob boss, a man with a violent history, and there's video to prove it. And again, in an ABC News poll shortly before the election, 43% of prospective voters polled said they felt that Donald Trump was more honest and trustworthy than Hillary Clinton, who polled at 36%. Even though Donald Trump's real estate high-rise buildings skip 10 floors to make them look taller than they are, it is a long, long way to the bottom. One of Donald Trump's appeals, I guess one could say, during the campaign was that his promise to get blue-collar workers whose jobs had been sent abroad or who simply had lost their jobs due to foreign competition. He vowed to fight for them and to make America great again and blah, 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 blah. This certainly had a lot to do with Trump's appeals to those elements of the white working class who were seduced by his message.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
A good insight into how Donald Trump treats blue-collar workers and those who are employed by him is in the chapter 9 of The Making of Donald Trump by David K. Johnston, this called The Polish Brigade. Before Donald Trump could erect Trump Tower, his signature building on Fifth Avenue, he had to knock down the Bonwit Teller department store, which had catered to fashionable women since 1929. Bonwit's 12-story facade was adorned with a pair of giant bas-relief panels considered priceless examples of the Art Deco era, two naked women with flowing scarves, dancers perhaps cut in limestone. The building's entry featured an immense grillwork made from Benedict nickel, hammered aluminum, and other materials, which gave it the impression of a lusciously large piece of jewelry when backlit at night. American Architect Magazine's 1929 appraisal of the building described it as, quote, a sparkling jewel in keeping with the character of the store, unquote. Trump assured those worried about the architectural treasures that he would give them to the Metropolitan Museum of Art if removal was not prohibitively expensive, a promise he would not keep. Instead of hiring an experienced demolition contractor, Trump chose Kozicki and Sons, contractors, a window washing business owned by a Polish emigre. Kozicki, by the K-A-S-Z-Y-C-K-I. Upward of 200 men began demolishing the building in midwinter of 1980. The men worked without hard hats. They lacked face masks, even though asbestos, known to cause incurable cancers, swirled all around them. They didn't have goggles to protect their eyes from the bits of concrete and steel that sometimes flew through the air like bullets. The men didn't have power tools either. They brought down the 12-story building with sledgehammers. Trump kept an eye on the project, not just when visiting the site where photographs show him smiling under a hard hat, parenthetically, of course, his workers were denied hard hats, but from an office he rented directly across Fifth Avenue, which offered him an unobstructed view. The demolition workers were not American citizens, but, quote, had recently arrived from Poland, unquote, a federal court later determined. The court also found that, quote, they were undocumented and worked off the books, unquote. No payroll records were kept. No Social Security or other taxes were withheld, and they were not paid in accordance with wage laws. They were told they would be paid $4, or in some cases, $5 an hour for working 12-hour shifts 7 days a week. In fact, they were paid irregularly and incompletely, unquote. Many members of the demolition crew, which became known as the Polish Brigade, lived at the work site, sleeping through the bitter cold on bare concrete floors. The crew numbered about 30 or 40 in the daytime, but swelled to as many as 200 at night when few people would be around the Tony Business District to observe the demolition work. Fed up that their paychecks kept bouncing, some of the workers corralled Thomas Macari, M-A-C-A-R-I, Trump's personal representative. They showed him to the edge of one of the higher floors and asked if he would like them to hang him over the side. The workers, likely hungry, demanded their pay. Otherwise, no work. When McCary told his boss what had happened, Trump placed a panicked telephone call to Daniel Sullivan, S-U-L-L-I-V-A-N, a labor fixer, FBI informant, suspect in the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, and Trump's personal negotiator for the Grand Hyatt contract with the Hotel Workers Union. Donald told me he was having some difficulties, Sullivan later testified. He admitted to me that, seeking my advice, he had some illegal Polish employees on the job. I reacted by saying to Donald that, quote, I think you're nuts. I told him to fire them promptly if he had any brains, unquote. As Sullivan later told me, along with reporter Wayne Barrett and others, hiring Polish workers who were in the country illegally and then having them work without standard safety equipment was not just foolish, it was reckless. For all his dealings with Trump, Sullivan was repeatedly astonished by the businessman's lack of prudence. He said that whenever Trump saw an opportunity to collect more money or to cut his costs by not paying people what they had earned, he did. Common sense just never took hold, unquote, when Trump had money on his mind, Sullivan told me several times. To Sullivan, only greed and an utter lack of regard for human life could allow Trump to let the Polish Brigade work without hard hats or the face masks they needed to keep asbestos from entering their lungs. Men were stripping electrical wires with their bare hands, Sullivan later testified. There is no record of any federal, state, or city safety inspector filing a report during the demolition. In the 1990 Trenton restaurant interview, I asked Sullivan how a project of this size could have been erected in the heart of Manhattan without attracting government job safety inspectors. Sullivan just looked at me. When I widened my eyes to make clear that I wanted an explicit answer, he said, "You know why," unquote. When I persisted, anticipating that Sullivan might specify bribes to inspectors, he said that unions and concrete suppliers were not the only areas where Trump's lawyer, Roy Cohn, had influence. Shortly after Trump called Sullivan, a new demolition crew arrived on the site. They were officially members of Housewreckers Local 95, but there were only 15 or so unionists among them. Normally employing non-union workers, in this case Kozicki and Sons at a union work site, would prompt an immediate shutdown. But, as federal court documents would later show, the Housewreckers union was firmly under the control of the mobsters whose consigliere was Roy Cohn, Trump's mentor and lawyer. So the union went along with a scheme to employ non-union workers, cheat them out of their pay, and shortchange the union health and pension funds. Several simple but clever techniques in filling out records ensured that the union received no written notice of the non-union workers. Not incidentally, those workers were nonetheless required to pay union initiation fees and had union dues deducted from their meager pay, even though, as a federal judge later concluded, they were never actually in the union. McCary, Trump's overseer, testified that he reviewed and approved these documents before paying Kozicki. Six Polish workers went to a lawyer named John Szabo, capital S-Z-A-B-O, for help getting paid. In early April, McCary saw to it that the window washing company Trump hired for the demolition job gave the six men a total of almost $5,000 in back pay. More workers then sought out Szabo. By July, as summer temperatures soared, the unpaid wages came to almost $104,000, even though the rate of pay was under $5 an hour with no overtime, despite a grueling 84-hour work week of heavy manual labor. One day, to keep the workers swinging their sledgehammers, McCary showed up with a wad of cash. Instead of paying the men directly, court papers show, McCary gave the money to the foreman. Anyone who wanted their money had to kick back $50 to the foreman, testimony showed. After that, McCary testified later, he handed cash directly to the Polish brigade members at least twice. After the building was taken down, a dissident member of the Housewreckers Union, Harry Dibuck, D-I-D-U-C-K, took the brave step of suing the corrupt union. Trump and an arm of Metropolitan Life Insurance, Trump's financial partner in Trump Tower. That, by the way, is MetLife, for the wages and benefits the Polish brigade members should have received. Beginning again, after the building was taken down, a dissident member of the Housewreckers Union, Harry Dibuck, took the brave step of suing the corrupt union, Trump, and an arm of Metropolitan Life Insurance, Trump's financial partner in Trump Tower, for the wages and benefits the Polish brigade members should have received. Trump insisted he owed nothing and filed motion after motion that delayed the proceedings, which his lawyers characterized as baseless and unfair. When the trial finally made it to federal court, Trump testified that he had no knowledge that any workers were underpaid or that the Polish workers lacked hard hats and other safety equipment. Judge Stewart, in a lengthy opinion, found that Trump's testimony lacked credibility. Can't imagine that, can you? One more time. Judge Stewart, in a lengthy opinion, found that Trump's testimony lacked credibility. The judge said it would have been easy to identify the Polish workers. They were the only ones on the demolition site without hard hats. Judge Stewart ruled that Trump had engaged in the conspiracy to cheat the workers of their pay. At the heart of this conspiracy was Trump's violation of his duty of loyalty, also known as fiduciary duty to the workers and to the union. This, quote, breach involved fraud, and the Trump defendants knowingly participated in this breach, Judge Stewart held. The judge awarded damages of $325,000 plus interest. Trump, who has consistently maintained he acted lawfully, appealed. He later settled. The agreement was sealed so that the amount Trump paid remains unknown. Bibik's dedication to his fellow workers showed amazing persistence. The sealed settlement took effect more than 18 years after the demolition began. There was no litigation over the destruction of the bas-relief facades and the valuable entryway grillwork which Trump had promised to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. A spokesman for Trump, who identified himself as John Barron, B-A-R-O-N, we'll find out who this is later, told the New York Times that Trump had ordered their destruction. Barron said three appraisers told Trump that the Art Deco sculpture was, quote, without artistic merit, unquote. Museum curators, the building's architect, and a host of architectural experts all said that was nonsense. Barron said removing the art would have cost Trump more than $500,000 in demolition delays, other unspecified expenses, and without explanation, additional taxes. That last item may have struck those following the dispute as curious. By donating the art, Trump would have qualified for an income tax deduction. Of course, that deduction would have no value if Trump did not owe any income taxes in 1980, as public records show was the case in 1978 and 1979, and would be again in 1984, 1992, 1994, and likely every other year since 1978. The entry grillwork that American Architect magazine had so highly praised a half century earlier just vanished. Barron said the grillwork and the limestone panels, if preserved, could not have been sold for more than $9,000. Art experts dismissed that as nonsense as well. The Metropolitan Museum said its 20th century art curators would never have requested the donation of objects that lacked artistic merit or had no value in the market. The museum said one appraiser had estimated the value of the art in hundreds of thousands of dollars. Others called the destroyed artifacts priceless, comparing them to the renowned artwork on the Rockefeller Center buildings. Otto J. Teegan, T-E-E-G-A-N, who designed the grillwork in 1929, was still alive in 1980. Barron had said the grillwork just disappeared. Teegan wasn't buying that. Teegan and others told the newspaper they were appalled. Teegan said the grill, quote, would have required cranes and trucks to be removed and could not merely be mislaid or easily stolen. It's not a thing you could slip in your coat and walk away with, unquote, since the heavy metal grillwork measured 15 by 25 feet. Trump spoke up days later saying safety concerns were his real worry, namely the fear of heavy limestone falling onto the sidewalk and street. My biggest concern was the safety of the people on the street below, he said. If one of those stones had slipped, people could have been killed. To me, it would not have been worth that kind of risk, unquote. Noted art dealer Robert Miller, who watched the destruction of the limestone sculptures from his gallery across the street, noticed how huge pieces of stone did in fact crash to the Fifth Avenue sidewalk. Quote, they were just jackhammered in half and pulled down in such a way that they just shattered. It was just tragic. They were very much in the Art Deco style, very beautiful and very gracious. Trump insisted that he was being cheap in destroying the art rather than preserving it to save what may have been about $32,000. Quote, I contribute that much every month to painters and artists. That's nothing, Trump said. Years later, as a presidential candidate, Trump would have little evidence to support his claim to being an ardent philanthropist. Quote, as we shall see. The destruction of the Bonwit Teller artwork, together with the Polish Brigade case, highlighted some of Trump's unscrupulous business practices. But it also brought to light another intriguing aspect of Trump's conduct, one that raises serious questions about the lack of judgment that troubled Daniel Sullivan. For years, Trump used fake identities to mislead journalists and at least once to menace someone who was just doing their duty. This will be examined after we take a look at some other aspects of Trump, including how emotions influence how much Trump says he is worth. And in Chapter 10, feelings and net worth. By the way, I'm not going to be putting long excerpts of text into the written descriptions of the program. I want people to go out and buy the book. It is not long at all. It's an easy read, but I want people to buy it, read it, tell people about it, communicate about it on the internet, social media, what have you. It is important. And again, neither myself nor any of the stations that carry this program have any financial stake in this.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Chapter 10, Feelings and Net Worth. Over more than four decades of promoting himself in public, Donald Trump has declared widely varying figures for his net worth. The numbers sometimes differ by billions of dollars in just a matter of days. In 1990, when his business empire was on the verge of collapse, Trump told me and many other journalists that he was worth $3 billion. He told others $5 billion. I got my hands on a copy of his personal net worth statement that spring, which revealed a much smaller figure. 2 months later, a report commissioned by his bankers and introduced in casino regulatory hearings put Trump in the red by almost $300 million. In the spring of 2015, as he prepared to run for the Republican presidential nomination, Trump declared his net worth on different days to be $8.7 billion, $10 billion, and in one case, $11 billion. Just how does Trump arrive at these fluctuating figures? They do not appear to take into account factors such as basic stock prices, changes in real estate values, and interest rates. Trump's net worth is central to his public persona as a kind of modern Midas. It is so important to him that he sued veteran journalist Tim O'Brien over a net worth estimate in his 2005 book, Trump Nation. O'Brien, who has edited my work in the New York Times, estimated Trump's worth at $150 million to $250 million based on documents Trump has shown him and statements from three unnamed sources. Trump's lawsuit said the correct figure was between $5 billion and $6 billion. A lawsuit accused O'Brien of deliberately undervaluing Trump's net worth so he could sell more books, causing irreparable damage to Trump's reputation as a billionaire. In pursuing the lawsuit, Trump testified under oath about his actual net worth, but his answers were not the dry recitation of asset values minus debts usually found in financial investigations. The testimony was quintessentially Trumpian. Mr. Trump, have you always been completely truthful in your public statements about your net worth of properties, unquote? O'Brien's lawyer asked. I try, Trump answered. Have you ever been not truthful? My net worth fluctuates and it goes up and down with markets and with attitudes and with feelings, even my own feelings. But I try, unquote. In that statement, attorney Andrew C. Ceresny, C-E-R-E-S-N-U-Y, of DeBevoise and Plimpton, D-E-B-E-V-O-I-S-E and Plimpton, who represented both O'Brien and his publisher, found exactly the opening he was looking for. Let me just understand that a little bit, Ceresny said. Let's talk about net worth for a second. You said that the net worth goes up and down based upon your own feelings? Yes, Trump answered. Even my own feelings as to where the world is, where the world is going, and that can change rapidly from day to day. Then you have a September 11th and you don't feel so good about yourself and you don't feel so good about the world and you don't feel so good about New York City. Then you have a year later and the city is as hot as a pistol. Even months after that, it was a different feeling. So yeah, even my own feelings affect my value to myself, unquote. When you publicly state what you're worth, the lawyer asked, what do you base that number on? I would say it's my general attitude at the time the question may be asked, and as I say, it varies, Trump replied. Trump's answers were a remarkably candid explanation of his behavior, which he modulates in public to polish the careful image of his ability to make money through deal artistry. Whether being under oath prompted his candor, or he simply felt relaxed after decades of lawsuits, is unknowable. A New Jersey State Appeals Court, in its 2011 decision dismissing Trump's lawsuit, concluded that Trump's testimony, quote, failed to provide a reliable measure, unquote, of his net worth that could be used to impeach O'Brien's reporting. In short, the core issue in Trump's lawsuit was not hard facts and figures, but Trump's feelings. The lawsuit had no basis in reality. The decision cited the document that O'Brien and Trump showed him three times, the Statement of Financial Conditions prepared by Weiser, W-E-I-S-E-R-L-L-P, Certified Public Accountants, unquote, as a measure of Trump's fortune. The judge wrote of that problematic document, a preface to that statement demonstrates its limited value as an accurate representation of Trump's net worth. The accountants cautioned that they had not audited or reviewed the accompanying statement of financial condition and accordingly do not express an opinion or any other form of assurance on it, unquote. Further, the accountants noted significant departures from generally accepting accounting principles and stated, quote, the effects of the departures from generally accepted accounting principles as described above had not been determined, unquote. Explaining the lack of audit or review, the judge quoted Gerald Rosenblum, R-O-S-E-N-B-L-U-M, one of the accountants who helped prepare the statement. Rosenblum testified that he did not try to independently assess Trump's financial condition. I asked the client to provide me with a list of liabilities as they existed at June 30, 2005, said Rosenblum. The client presented me with a list in essence. I'm not certain to this day that I was aware of all of Mr. Trump's liabilities at that point in time, and I sought no corroboration, unquote. The ruling said that Trump's right to collect income in the future was presented as a certainty without regard to the fact that, under the terms of his contracts, the flow of money might be reduced or even stop. More important, the judge wrote that Trump had not disclosed facts needed to determine his net worth. The values of Trump's closely held businesses were not expressed in terms of assets or net of liabilities, unquote, the judge wrote, before adding two crucial insights. Insights to speak to how Trump could make his net worth seem to be vastly larger than it is by any standard objective measure. Quote, the ownership percentages of each closely held business by Trump were not disclosed. Additionally, the tax consequences on Trump's holdings were not set forth, unquote. The court also took renewed interest in Trump's stake in the West Side Yards in Manhattan, which more than three decades earlier had been the focus of a federal grand jury investigation in which Trump was a target. No charges were filed. The New Jersey judge's dismissal order held that the West Side Yards, the largest single piece of land available for development in Manhattan, was not, quote, owned, unquote, by Trump as often claimed. Rather, as Trump Nation reported, Trump was subject to a partnership agreement with terms that might not be worth a dollar to him. Under oath, Trump admitted that, in the judge's words, quote, under the partnership agreement, the general partners would have to recover their entire investment before Trump would see any return. As a consequence, his future profits remained speculative, unquote. Any possible future profits are uncertain because encumbrances on the property were not disclosed by Trump, unquote. As often as Trump overstates his property's worth, the judge's decision also points out how he also understates or even hides debts and other liabilities or encumbrances, like mortgages. In 1985, Trump made a show of buying Mar-a-Lago, the Palm Beach, Florida estate of Marjorie Meriwether Post, the serial heiress who went on to run her own cereal company and became arguably the wealthiest woman in America. Post left the property to the federal government in 1973 as a winter home for the president, but Washington decided the upkeep of more than 110,000 square feet with 126 rooms and lavish grounds was more than taxpayers should bear. They put it on the market. Trump said he paid cash for the property, which he described as run down and in need of the Trump touch to restore its grandeur. No mortgage was involved, he said, just cash. I put in a cash offer of $5 million plus another $3 million for the furnishings in the house, Trump wrote in his first book. That was not quite true. In testimony 5 years later, Trump confirmed that his primary bank, Chase Manhattan, had loaned him the entire purchase price. We have been reading and will be reading for intermittent programs for some time from The Making of Donald Trump by David K. Johnston, published in hardcover by Melville House. Again, the descriptions for this show will have a few text excerpts, but not as long as I usually do. Please buy the book, read it, tell other people about it. It is not a long book or an expensive one. It is, however, very important and stands as a remarkable chevron to American institutions and its citizenry. This concludes For the Record program number 934, The Making of Donald Trump, subtitled Top Banana Republic, Part 3, being recorded on November 23rd of 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.